Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, free speech and campaign finance. And Richard, we turn to this topic today because the midterms having just passed, we're on the eve of another presidential election cycle. And we see a number of very wealthy individuals who can do a lot to finance their own campaigns lining up for a shot at the presidency. Of course, President Trump himself falls into that category, but so too do people like Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, who's considering a run, or Tom Steyer, the liberal billionaire from California, who's doing the same. And this has led you to write for Defining Ideas, a piece about money in politics. And of course, the evergreen issue here is how far the free speech rights of people who want to spend money on politics extend if one is considering spending on politics a form of free speech. And you say early on in this piece that I'm quoting you here, freedom of speech, like the freedom of contract, is always subjected to principled regulation, close quote. So you argue there should be a presumption in favor of freedom, but it's not necessarily an absolute. So start off by describing for us some of the situations where it seems clear to you that regulation might be appropriate.
Well, I think the first thing to do is to take the next sentence in that thing, which is, you know, freedom of speech, as you said, like freedom of contract and so forth, are subject to various forms of regulation. Well, look at freedom of contract and ask yourself the kinds of things that are proper topics of regulation and then how that regulation ought to be executed. And the first thing you note is that in a freedom of contract world, nobody is allowed to engage in fraud. Nobody's allowed to engage in deception. Nobody's allowed to engage in any kind of coercion or duress with respect to anybody else. And there's also another rule out there of great importance in the political situation. If A has a duty to B and C comes along, he cannot try to induce A to breach his duty to B in order to gain some advantage. Inducement to breach of contract is a very bad thing in the law of contract, and you can do that by bribery, you can do it by extortion and so forth. Particularly on the bribery side, all of that stuff is out of place because freedom of contract does not allow you to ask somebody who's a public official to deviate from the requirements of his or her particular office. This is a huge constraint, and then how does it cash itself out? Well, in the immediate case, it's quite clear that you can say, I hereby promise to pay you a bribe if you will veto the following legislation. That is as pure speech as you could imagine. It might even count as political speech, but by virtue of the fact that it's a bribery situation, it's going to get you into deep trouble. And the same thing if somebody says to you, I know you're president, but I will give all the wealth that I have to your opponent unless you veto the following bill, that also will get you into sort of very difficult problems. So these kind of immediate quid pro quo kinds of arrangements should be illegal. Now, do you only have ex post sanctions? That is, after somebody commits something like this, that you then go after him? That, it turns out to be extremely dangerous. And so there was a statute called the Hatch Act, not our Orrin Hatch, but another Hatch, passed in 1939. And what that particular statute said is that if you are, in fact, in a public office, you cannot actively participate in any kind of a campaign. They're not saying that you can't vote or talk to your friends and so forth, but the basic intuition is if you're an employee and you start getting involved in politics, we may not be able to identify the cases where you've been influenced, but we're sure that they exist. So the only thing that works well is a prophylactic rule. And what that rule does, in effect, is to stop you from doing these kinds of activities. And the Supreme Court, just before its Buckley and Valeo decision, upheld that kind of restriction. So at the very least, all of these things are in place. And so the hard question when you think about freedom of speech is, after you have this particular structure in place as a limitation on what candidates can do and what public officials can do, what else do you then need?
You mentioned Buckley v. Valeo there. That is sort of the key early case on campaign finance from 1976. And as you describe in the piece, this deals with three different kinds of political spending. And you argue that we can understand a lot about the system that developed from the asymmetries and how the court treated those different kinds of spending. Break that down for us.
Well, it turns out that the original scheme thought that there were case number one, campaign contributions made by individuals to other individuals for the purpose of candidacy. Case number two is where you happen to support a candidate or an issue, and what you do is you make independent expenditures on behalf of that candidate or issue, but do not coordinate your activities with those of the candidate that happens to be involved in a particular election. And the third is people who wish to run for public office, and what they now decide to do is to simply finance their self-campaign. The original Campaign Finance Act, the Federal Election Commission Act of 1971, I think it was, basically put limits on all of these. The limit, which is, I think, most notable, was the amount under this particular statute that you could spend was $50,000 for running for president. And then there were $1,000 limitations that you could make to individual campaigns as by way of contributions. And there were essentially a $25,000 limit. And then there were a very complicated set of limits with respect to the kind of expenditures you could make as independent party. And so what they try to do is to basically put everything in a pressure cooker and then clamp down the top and hope that the whole thing would not explode. The Supreme Court looked at these three things and it said as follows. We understand why there's a need to deal with limits on campaign contributions, and so we're going to respect that limit. And we really think is that people understand when they make a contribution, they're trying to engage in an expressive form of democracy, and they don't care about the amount of money, which I regard as pie in the sky. And then with respect to these independent campaigns, they said, well, here the real money matters, and everybody knows that it's expensive to run some kinds of political campaign, so we're just taking the whole top off. And then for the individual who wants to run for public office, there was no limitation that was allowed there either, because the argument is if you're spending your own money, nobody could corrupt you. What they list on that last point is you could spend a lot of money trying to corrupt other people in order to get them to work on the campaign. So what happens is you now find that small people are basically subject to very heavy regulations. This independent group is very nebulous because it's very hard to police the line between collaboration and non-collaboration with political parties when there are overlaps and common missions and public statements. And then you get this last situation where anybody who wants to spend $1 billion here or there can do so. And that's where, of course, the opening is made for somebody like Michael Bloomberg. He would not be seriously considering this campaign if the $50,000 limitation were put on it. And indeed, as a kind of a down payment on a possible campaign, he spends $80 million in the last cycle in order to help key Democrats win in key elections, and he can do that without limitations so long as he avoids the entanglement provisions that I reversed to. So everybody understands that the system is deeply unstable, and the groups go in two directions. Somebody wants to remove all of these limitations, and other people want to extend all of these limitations, so that what we see is a widespread belief that the discontinuities make no sense, no agreement on how to overcome them, so that the only thing that has happened of a major nature since that time has been that we now have a total prohibition, at least had one under the Bipartisan Campaign Act of 2002 or so, in the McCain-Feingold bill, in which all corporate contributions made within 60 days of a general election for a president or 30 days in a primary, you couldn't make soft money gifts to these unaffiliated organizations. This was sustained in 2003 on the ground it was part of the Good Progressive campaign to try to keep money out of politics, and it was struck down in Citizens United about 7 years later on the ground that freedom of speech extends to corporations and certainly to a corporation like Citizens United, whose only product is making, in fact, political films. In that case, a film about Hillary Clinton.
Richard, there was an argument that you used to hear a lot from conservatives, which was that people should essentially be able to spend as much as they wanted on politics, with the only real proviso being disclosure requirements so that the public would know who was funding whom. In recent years, the right has been considerably less enthusiastic about that idea. So explain what changed and how we ought to think about striking a balance between protecting people's privacy and the public's right to know.
Yeah, so the point about the disclosure requirement was, yes, we want to know who it is that you're beholden to. And so you take these small contributions, and you have to have very accurate accounting requirements and disclosure requirements. It was ridiculous. Some of the legislation requires disclosure of campaign contributions of $10 or $11, which is not going to basically flip everybody. And the theory was that, you know, public information is a disinfectant, and everybody will have a more informed debate. Well, one thing starts to happen, which is that the information does not essentially go to the public to decide whether or not to vote for a candidate. What it does is it starts to be used, particularly in recent years, by media groups to savage certain people and to lead to massive campaigns against them, to try to hound them in their homes, to drive them out of their jobs, to make their lives all around miserable. And so now it's not just conservatives, I would hope. Everybody says the risk of retaliation has become so great that disclosure of individual names has now become a very dangerous situation. And if we allow this to persist, it means that people who would otherwise want to participate in politics will not do so. And I would say there are two observations that tend to support that. One, which is modestly significant, is that the Federalist Papers were, of course, not written by Jay, Madison, and Hamilton. They were written by Publius. I think everybody pretty much knew who they were, but still, the notion of anonymous publication was, I think, serious. But the more important illustration is the secret ballot. And, you know, there have been people like John Stuart Mill who took the position everybody ought to be prepared to defend their vote in public, as if everybody had a IQ of 190 the way this guy did. But it turns out we do protect the secret ballot, and we do so because we don't want people to be subject to intimidation by party bosses or various friends of one kind or another. And I think that that analogy, given the pervasiveness of the retaliation, extends to the contribution of money which is used to buy influence in order to change the way in which people start to vote. So I have sort of switched my own view on this. In one of his recent opinions on this, Justice Thomas took exactly the same position. The rest of the court is yet to come over. The Wall Street Journal, as you mentioned, was at one time perfectly in favor of the disclosure requirement. As of late, it has expressed some real difficulties. One of my friends, Bob Bauer, who's a real expert on all of this stuff, suggested that what you might require is a disclosure of the kinds of groups that support you by stripping all the identifiers of individual names, so you could say this person was supported by agricultural interests or by lumbering interests or something of the sort. It's kind of tricky to know if you can actually implement this. One of the issues you see in all the medical case of privacy is how quickly can somebody reconstruct the source of a particular medical record with the few identifiers they have. And it turns out you can do an amazing amount with very, very little stuff. So the technical question, on which I really don't have an opinion, is whether or not you could make this categorical disclosure work, but you can understand why it's a perfectly sensible idea. What it does is it gives people in the public at large the information that they need the most, while it protects people's privacy interests in the area where that's its greatest. And so if you can actually find a way to pull all of this stuff off, it might be a way out of a very unpleasant difficulty. But this is a much more difficult issue than one used to think. It is also the case that you get people in public offices, you're in favor of net neutrality, and all of a sudden everybody's outside your door threatening you with one thing or another. The Kavanaugh nominations show the same kind of situation. And it seems to me that at a certain point, the privacy stuff won't help, because there's no way you can say, you know what we're going to do is we're going to consider whether or not Mr. Kavanaugh should be appointed to the Supreme Court, and we're going to do it in secret. It's not going to happen. And if it's not going to happen, then the problem that I'm talking about will continue to exist, even if you can protect people who are making expenditures either by way of campaign contributions or independent expenditures.
One proposal that you hear sometimes from the left is getting rid of the current arrangement altogether and moving towards a system of public financing, where essentially if somebody decided to run for office, the arrangement would be you all get the same amount of money, it comes from the taxpayers, and you don't raise any yourself. The theory being that you free people up to actually focusing on campaigning instead of fundraising, and you reduce their incentives to do the bidding of any particular donor. What's your reaction to proposals like that?
Well, the first thing you have to do is to figure out what the amounts are going to be. And essentially, to run a presidential campaign in 2020, it could probably cost you $500 million or $1 billion, which I don't think to be an inordinate sum of money, given the amount that's at stake with the outcome of the election. I mean, my view is the selection of a president, think Trump versus Clinton, could probably influence the total size of the economy by at least $1 trillion, and certainly the distribution of the benefits of that economy by even more than that amount. And if you've got this much that's going to be at stake, somebody's going to be able to spend money somehow. And so if you try to do this and say to the president, Kennedy, here you can get your paltry $50 or $100 million, spend it as you see fit, you know what's going to happen. There are going to be all sorts of independent campaigns that are going to grow up, and they are going to do exactly what they do today, only they won't be under the control of the presidential nominee, so that you're going to have lots of gaffes and confusions and uncertainty. We know that when this was offered, everybody has turned it down because the outside money is just simply too large. So I don't think it's very good for that reason. Another reason is, you know, it's going to be awfully difficult, particularly in primary periods, for outsiders to get in under this system. They can't use their own money, and it's certainly not going to be the case that if Richard Epstein says, I'm running for president, somebody's going to give him a $75 million in order to run his campaign unless he crosses some threshold. Well, how do you do that early run? Do you allow people to spend their own money? So now they spend a huge amount of money, and they've got this huge advantage going into it, and then they are willing to settle for the other, but somebody else can't do it. So you're still going to have the money in politics problem. It will just be moved back to an earlier stage, and it may have the very harmful consequence of making sure that no credible outsider is able to do this. If you start running the kind of minimum share stuff, take the very fractured Democratic field, some with high visibility and some with known. If you require, say, 10%, and you've got 12 or 13 candidates for this thing, by definition, three of them are going to come short. You really want to say to somebody who gets 7% in the first primary, you're out forevermore, when in fact they may be building momentum, and so that the current vote is not indicative of what their future position is going to be. I just don't believe that anything of that particular sort should work. I think in the end, what you have to do is to sort of open the whole thing up. It used to be thought that if you did so, it would be right-wing corporate types that would take over the world. Donald Trump doesn't fall into that category, whatever else he may be. And certainly Bloomberg doesn't fall into that category. And Tom Steyer is the antichrist when it comes to the conservative movement on these issues. He doesn't fall there either. One of the things that's so crazy is that the old assumptions at the time that you talked about Buckley and Vallejo, that the Democrats were the party of labor unions and they did it by brawn and by individual labor, and the Republicans were business types and they did it by financial campaigns and buying fancy advertisement firms. This political landscape is much more muddled. You're not quite sure which way the benefits are going to run, one way or the other. It is worth remembering in the last round, the Democrats outraised the Republicans, what, by, was it 2-1, Trump?
That sounds about right to me.
Yeah, I mean, well, you
remember off the top of my head.
You know, this is a huge switch from everything else. And if you start looking at all the major tech titans whose net worth is rather large, they're all headed by people whom you would call liberal Democrats. I did see a list, apropos of nothing, which talked about the wealthiest corporations in the United States by years. And, you know, it's been 6 years, it's been Apple. They may be displaced this year. Before that, it was ExxonMobil. Well, that's a rather different thing. And before that, it was General Electric, which is now on the verge of bankruptcy. Right? This was only 15 years ago. And then there's Microsoft, which may now be worth more again than Apple or Amazon or Google. But, you know, there are several of these firms which are consistently liberal democratic firms, and they seem to be willing to do this. My own view about this, and I talked about this when I wrote about Citizens United many years ago, is if you looked at the corporations that were prepared to say, please let us spend as much corporate money as we can on political campaigns for president, the list of corporations was zero. There's not a single major Fortune 500 corporation that was prepared to sign anything like that. The AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce were overjoyed about signing on to those kinds of a prospect because they actually do want to have that degree of freedom. Most corporations understand the following principle, which is that they give money to popular campaigns, and it turns out that somebody doesn't like it. Boy, do they remember it. And if somebody actually approves of what they're doing, they say, oh, it's nice that they did it, and forget about it. So the negatives are so much more potent than the positives that the only thing you can do is to run for cover. And so that was part of the irony of the Citizens United case. This was, you know, a political campaign by a political body. The call of the corporation is to say, well, the New York Times is a corporation, so they can't speak either. They're both in the press business. And one of the things that we now know is it's much more difficult than it had been in previous years to figure out who is a member of the press, because entry is so easy and the number of outlets are so numerous that we never know. But Mr. Seneca, I think you and I are both members of the press and therefore entitled to very special presidential and constitutional protection.
So the final question that I'll put to you, on the left, there may be a temptation to try to banish money from politics on ideological grounds, I suppose. But as you drift towards the center, it seems to me that the animating concern for a lot of people is a more practical one about corruption, as you mentioned earlier. They want to know that their elected officials or candidates are making decisions based on what they think is best for the voters rather than based on who's cutting them a check. And of course, that criticism extends beyond campaign finance. It goes into lobbying and other areas as well. Yeah. If restrictions on giving aren't the way to tackle that problem, are there other ways of getting at it that make more sense to you?
Well, first of all, just trying to regulate to presidential campaigns and congressional elections isn't going to do it, because issue lobbying is extremely important, both direct to Congress and also by writing public papers. I have written many papers on behalf of clients and published them in Forbes, occasionally on the Hoover side, dealing with such topics as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because all of these organizations want to make sure that their view is heard out in the public at large, and they're perfectly entitled to do so. Under those circumstances, I think as an author, you're duty bound to make a disclosure, and I always have. But it would be inconceivable for me to say that, oh no, you have to shut that off on any side. Then it also turns, can you present your case to Congress? And put it the following way. Nobody in Congress has the staff or the resources on a complex issue to draft any legislation. They are all beholden to people in the industry who care about something. And the way it has been put to me, very forcefully, say, you know, you're writing something and you're writing it for us. And if you tell the straight scoop and you give them decent advice and they pass a piece of legislation or support a piece of legislation that garners them respect, it's wonderful. But you take one false step and put them into a position in which they are embarrassed or humiliated, you'll never hear the end of it and nobody will trust you again. So the reputational constraints have a lot of influence on the way in which various lobbyists start to work, particularly lobbyists who represent commercial interests. Because these groups, essentially, once the bad word gets out, it not only influences their lobbying efforts, but also their business efforts as well. And they have a reputation which they are held hostage to when they start to misbehave. Activist groups don't have that problem at all. If you're representing a strong environmental group trying to stop a pipeline or a nuclear plant or something of the sort, you don't have to figure out a way to please a broad consumer market who's interested in buying toothpaste. What you have to do is to figure out whether or not your aggressive stance are going to play well with the 500,000 donors that you have, and taking strongly partisan positions is generally going to be just fine. And if you make a mistake and you overstate or you get embarrassed, it's going to cost you a little, but it's generally not nearly as much, because your audience is going to be more forgiving. So there's this peculiar kind of asymmetry that takes place in this political market, where those people who are sort of anti from the outside have a much greater freedom of action than those people who are insiders in the way in which they start to deal with this. Now, sometimes you get insiders on both sides of a case. You get business versus business. And this happens all the time. For example, when the tobacco companies are sued by the health companies and things like that, and the market gets very complicated. But I think it's utterly impossible to assume that anybody in government could function without the information that is supplied by private lobbying groups, and everything would come to a complete halt. So it's just not going to happen. As I said in the Coover column, there's only one way in which you can change this, and that's not going to happen either, which is to shrink the size of the federal government and to make property rights more definite so there's less that politicians can do by subject matter and a small degree of freedom with respect to the things that they want to do, because they always have to pay in order to make these kinds of changes under the takings clause. That was the pre-1937 arrangement, roughly speaking. People who don't know this field particularly well would be surprised to learn that the scope of the federal government now is probably 100 times greater than it was 100 years ago. And that opens up the situation to all sorts of power and intrigue. Water will find its own level. There is so much discretion, so much to be gained on every side of these issues, that if you try to regulate part of the game, what will happen is you'll create an island. You may be able to keep it dry by building a high moat around it, but the seas around you will continue to surge, and it's in those areas that the same kinds of political intrigue will take place. I'm afraid that this is here for us for the wrong time. The only thing I think that deregulation of campaign finances can do is to get rid of some of the odd discontinuities. I don't think it's going to solve this problem, but the one nice piece about this, I don't think what I'm saying here is a kind of a pro-Republican, pro-Democrat, pro-labor, pro-business, pro-environment type thing. I think, in effect, nobody actually knows who's going to be the net winner for many of these transformations, and that puts us behind something of a modest veil of ignorance, which probably makes this a bit better world than the one we currently have.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.